Oi, Andy.
Peter Pan 2 is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas executions are no longer public. Join us to lift the curtain on a process Texas would rather keep under wraps. The lethal injection killing of Peter Cantu in Huntsville, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporters outside the death house, Dennis Longmire and Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Professor David Oshinsky, a Pulitzer Prize winning author whose latest book is Capital Punishment on Trial. The Execution Watch begins.
Now, the music you're hearing is from Victoria Panetti. You can find her by Google searching She Monster. And we have Dennis Longmire on the phone. Dennis, are you there? Dennis, are you there?
Hello?
Dennis, are you there?
You are breaking up. I can't hear you.
Well, I can hear you fine.
Okay, I now hear you.
Okay.
We are here on the corner. There are about 30 people in the general vicinity of the corner. It's hard to say how many of those 30 are here opposing the death penalty and how many are here in support of it. It's the crowd is fairly mixed, but there is also a large group of people about a block from us who are here clearly celebrating the execution in support of it. There have been waves of people who have walked by us. So I don't know if you can hear in the background the bullhorn.
All you have to do is get on the phone, call up your legislative office and say, we don't want to be number one in execution anymore. We want to be number one in justice.
Yes, we can hear. We can hear the microphone.
Pardon me?
We can hear the microphone.
Yes, you can hear the microphone. One of the things that strikes me about this particular execution is how much anger there is among the people who have been walking by here who are in favor of the execution. One young woman confronted a group of us and began just screaming. She was holding a sign, something like instant ticket to hell in support of the execution of Mr. Cantu. And it just worries me that there is that much anger and hate that is brought to the surface through these kind of actions.
Well, Dennis, I think the anger is probably generated by Andy Kahn and a publicity campaign that has gone on for 17 years.
Certainly, the media attention and the publicity kind of amplifies that anger and hatred. But from what I can sense, these are people who are genuinely angry, and they're angry about the problem of crime. They're angry about their fear about violence, and it worries me that they place so much hope in something like killing in response to that anger and that fear that they have.
Well, have you seen any crossing of the witnesses?
The witnesses for the media have gone in the building. We have not seen any witnesses for Mr. Cantu, and so we really don't know. I'm presuming that there will be witnesses on his behalf, but they haven't yet entered the building. And so from what I can gather, we're still waiting.
Okay, Dennis, what I'm going to do is we're going to proceed with the program, and you will get back in touch with Elizabeth when
okay.
The occasion comes.
Okay.
And that was Dennis Lundmeyer. And what has happened here is that this has gotten off to a very different start. And that's not a surprise. This has been certainly the Execution Watch show that we have done that has had more publicity over a period of 17 years. Peter Cantu is now 35 years old. At the time this crime was committed, he was just barely legal enough to be executed. He was 18. He and a group of other people, most of whom were apparently under 18 years of age. There were people that were gathered in the woods for some kind of gang ritual. Victims of opportunity passed. There was coming and going back and forth. And we've doing that. We've now got Dave Atwood on the thing. Dave, are you there?
We're here.
Okay. Where is here?
Here is the corner of West Alabama and Woodhead, right in front of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church.
All right, that's a different location for the Houston Vigil.
Yeah.
Now we got word from Dennis in Huntsville that there's a good bit of tension up there in the street because he said there are a good many demonstrators, perhaps outnumbering those in concern with the continued execution or those in favor of this execution, and that this is a very different case in that atmosphere. And what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, our position always on the death penalty is that even for horrific crimes, and we all know that this is terrible, a horrible crime, it caused a lot of pain and suffering, but we're against the death penalty, you know, in all circumstances. There have been other cases like this, too, where that question has come up, you know, is this a case that would warrant the death penalty? And our answer to that is always no. Because we have other alternatives, and we don't have to take somebody's life despite the horrible thing that they've done. So we're against it in all cases. But at the same time, I think, you know, we try to ourselves recognize that these crimes that took place were horrible. They were so bad that you can't even hardly, you know, comment on them. They were just terrible, and but still, the death penalty we don't think is the answer to this problem. I think we get caught up in it. It's almost like a diversion. If people are really concerned about these horrible crimes, we should really be focusing more on how to prevent these kind of crimes and reduce them. And anybody that thinks that the death penalty is an answer in terms of solving any problem that we have in our society, I think they're just misled. It may give some people some momentary satisfaction that they've taken care of a bad person, so to speak, but it doesn't really resolve the issue of violence and crime in our society. And so that's sort of our position on that, Ray.
Dave Atwood is a board member and a founder of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Dave, is the Houston organization active?
Yes, we're very active. We've got, I think, on our email list in the Houston area, I think that we're up somewhere around 200 people, Ray.
Okay, and you have meetings, and how do people?
We have periodic meetings. We don't have regular monthly meetings anymore. We wait till it looks like a good time to have a meeting. Then we have a meeting. So it ends up about maybe once a quarter that we have meetings. We've got the Journey of Hope coming in October. I think you're going to interview Bill Pelkey on your show.
Yeah, but Bill's already been in touch with me. He's kind of interesting and all that. And interested in not only this show, but the present show as well. For people to get in touch and keep in contact, they can go to www.tcadp.org. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. How many vigilants you got out?
We got 11.
That's a good turnout for Houston Vigil.
It was pretty good.
Yes.
We had But, you know, the other thing that's interesting, real quickly, the River Oaks area Democratic women are also meeting at the church. So we've had people stop by from that are going into that meeting and say hello to us, including Sissy Farenthold just went into that
meeting. Yeah, the road women are a pretty strong bunch.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I think at least the majority of them probably oppose the death penalty. I don't know if they all do, but they're a good group of people. And so we've had a lot of people come through this area. And, you know, I'd say out of tooting horns and giving us thumbs up, I'd say the great majority have given us a thumbs up being out here today. I wasn't quite sure because of this particular crime if we might get a little bit different reaction from the public going by. But it's been pretty steady against the death penalty, which is, you know, encouraging to us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dave.
Okay. Good, Ray. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. If you will convert that into an acronym and add.org, then you can get in touch with him. I'm back in the studio with our old friend Jim. Jim? This is apparently starting out to be a different kind of case in Huntsville.
Well, you know, it was mentioned the fact that there's a lot of anger. Well, Peter Cantu hasn't done a hell of a lot to make it any lesser anger.
Yeah,
less anger.
My impression is he started his trial before anybody else did.
Well,
he's quoted, and you know, I'm always skeptical of these more sensational things that you're reading in the newspaper because you've got an advocate out there that likes to make things sensational.
Talking about Andy Kahn.
Andy Kahn. In the case that I'm most familiar with, the Paul Broussard case, Andy Kahn came out with the assailants used boards with nails in them, although there were no nail board strike injuries on any of the victims, but it made a colorful image. And Peter Cantu is quoted by someone as having said he wanted to kill somebody to see what it was like well before this incident happened. And so that creates an atmosphere of drama that is almost inescapable. And that has kind of surrounded this case since the very beginning.
Well, apparently from evidence brought out during the trial, the neighbors all hated him because he was obnoxious and horrible in the neighborhood. And they'd have parties oftentimes just prior to the killing when a lot of kids would show up, and when girls would go by, they'd say real vulgar things and hoot and holler at him. He was a problem at school. He got in a lot of fights. He tried to whip a teacher, threatened to kill security guards. And so it wasn't just what Atwood might have said. He might have exaggerated, but believe me, Peter Cantu provided a lot of fodder, because what happened, he's always been considered kind of the ringleader of this group, and what had occurred, Peter Cantu and probably six or seven or eight, it's hard to tell for certain, young kids were in a park, and they were initiating a 14-year-old kid into their gang. And supposedly Peter Cantu was the head of this gang and didn't have a name, but to be initiating this gang, they did that typical thing. The 14-year-old had to fight every gang member, and that's what they do. They'd all take turns fighting. And they got their blood all kind of pumped up, and while they were doing all of this, when they got through with the fighting, when the initiation part was over with, they were drinking beer. And you add alcohol to testosterone, and you get these brains of teenage kids together. You got dynamite on your hands. And what had happened, two young girls, one 14 and one 16, were on their way home, trying to get home before their parents' curfew, and they took a shortcut. And they were going down some railroad tracks and got near to where the gang members were. And one of the guys by the name of Jose Medellin, the one that was a guy from Mexico, Medellin, grabbed one of the girls and jerked her down, and the other girl came back to help her, and Cantu grabbed this girl. And they took him out in the clearing, and from this was all trial evidence. It didn't anything that Atwood or anybody else has added. They sodomized them, had anal intercourse with them, made them have oral sex with them. They beat them. They robbed them, and they did everything sexually you can do to two young women. And then when they were doing all of this, all the gang members took turns doing it. Because some of the guys said, look, we don't do that, and they left. Some of the Sandoval brothers said, man, we don't rape women, we don't kill women, we're out of here, and they left. And then Peter Cantu said to the kid they were initiating, we're going to have to kill the girls and keep them being witnesses. And so they take them to the woods. And what makes this particularly really bad?
But they left some of the others out of it because they felt they were too young and tender.
One kid, the one 14-year-old kid, they said, you're too young to see this. They took the girls to the woods, and the way they killed them was very gruesome. They killed one girl by wrapping a belt around her neck, and one gang member got one in the belt, and one of the other ones started pulling until the belt broke. Then they got her shoestrings wrapped around her neck and pulled it until she died. And they did the same thing to the 16-year-old girl, and she begged them not to kill her, but they went ahead and did the same thing to her. And then, after they killed them, they stomped them on the neck, kicked them in the mouth, stomped their bodies, knocked out the teeth of some of the girls, cracked some ribs on more of them, and stepped on them, make sure it stepped on their throats, make sure they were dead. Now, that's bad enough, but then what happens after the killing is over with? They go to Peter Cantu's brother's house and start bragging and laughing about what they had done. It's not something that they were ashamed about. And what's kind of ironical about that, I've been around several murder cases where people have strangled other people, and you don't die immediately when you're strangled.
No, that's not an easy way to
die. No, and you're right in close proximity, and usually most people are pretty upset by it. They have nightmares over it. And these kids were laughing about it and thought it was real funny and talked and laughed about it. We had a couple with a couple of white chicks. You should have been there laughing about it. Well, Peter Cantu's brother's Joe, the wife, was quite upset at what they had done. So 4 days later, of course, all the news hit when the little girls didn't show up. And all the parents kind of go berserk, and they start looking for their two children. And what happened, Joe Cantu, Peter Cantu's brother, his wife, was nagging him to do something about it because she was pretty alarmed by what the boys had done.
Mm-hmm.
So he made an anonymous call to Crime Stoppers and told them where the bodies would be found. And when the police couldn't find them, he made a second call to Crime Stoppers, said, you know, go to a different location in the park, and that's when they found the bodies. Then they traced the phone call back to his house.
Mm-hmm.
And so at trial, Joe Cantu and his wife both testified as to what these boys did after the killing, how casual they were and cavalier they were, plus the trial testimony about the fact they even went to jail. In the jails, they bragged and laughed at what they had done. Everybody involved, all the adults, were given the death penalty. Two have already been executed. This is the last one. And the other two, their death sentences were commuted to life when the Supreme Court case came out that you couldn't execute somebody under the age of 18. And that's the reason they're not executed. So thus far, we've had two people executed.
So this is the third.
This is the
third final
one.
This is the final act.
So although it might have been exaggerated by some of the victim rights advocates, believe me, Peter Cantu has given them a lot of fodder to work with because he was not exactly a modern. In fact, as one teacher said, he's not the sort of student you forget. Because what makes it particularly bad is that they're young girls, the way they were killed, the way they were sexually assaulted. The boy's attitude after they killed him, laughing and bragging about it, bragging about it to their family even, being so open about what they had done, thinking it was funny. That sort of stuff makes people absolutely crazy. And I can certainly understand why there'd be a lot of anger about this case. And truthfully, it's kind of hard to exaggerate what they did. It'd almost be impossible to exaggerate it. Or you could say, well, they lied and said the belts had studs on it when they choked them. But still, it's a real gruesome, horrible crime.
Well, you know, when this case was fresh, I took a look at it from the perspective of the a book called The Lord of Flies, where a bunch
I'm
of kids,
with
yeah,
right?
When a bunch of kids get stranded on an island without any supervision whatsoever, and the result of all of that lack of supervision was you developed kind of a dog pack mentality, and they divided into two factions, and one of the factions was supposed to be better than the other faction, but neither faction was acceptable by any level of moral or ethics that we live by. And you get a bunch of kids together, and you mix in alcohol, and you mix in their ritual, and it becomes a dog pack mentality kind of phenomenon.
What I thought of, Ray, when I read this, I remember reading the book in Cold Blood, where the psychiatrist who examined Perry Smith and Bill Hickok did the killing. What he ended up saying is that neither person alone would have committed the crime. but the combination of the two personalities created a third psychological being that did the killing. And I think the same thing is true when you get a bunch of kids, because that's why you draft people when they're 18 and 19. You don't get them when they're older because they're willing to kill and they like all the excitement.
Right.
They haven't got good sense at that age.
Well, so the military kind of takes advantage of this unique occurrence.
Of course. You don't. You know, that's why they draft these young kids and send them to war. I mean, an adult wouldn't do it. And so I think what happens, I like what that manager, the manager psychiatrist said, that a third psychological being did the killing, that probably neither boy alone would have done this. But together, that mentality, that testosterone flowing, and remember, they just got through fighting, and people don't like to admit it, but there's a sexual component to fighting, to violence.
Of course,
and that stirs up their hormones. You add some alcohol to it, and you have an 18-year-old brain trying to control that, plus you have them being macho with one another. And they want to be tough and rough. And the only thing I think about this case from my viewpoint that's kind of sad, and there's not much you can do about it, it's kind of the way life is. It is pretty bad when your conduct as an adult is controlled by the decisions you make when you're 18 years of age.
Yeah.
But that's just the facts of life.
Which is facts of our legal atmosphere.
Well, it's the same thing. You know, if you smoke, you're going to eventually get lung cancer or emphysema. When you do certain things or certain results that flow from it, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Has it ever been different?
No.
Hold on. We've got Dennis, I think, on the line. Hello, Dennis. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray, and I'm going to give the mic to Gloria. She's going to talk with you. She's been watching and visiting the whole thing. So here's
where do I talk?
Hello, Gloria. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ray. Hi.
Hi.
The execution has taken place. At first, we thought maybe there was something happening because after the media walked in, there was no witnesses walking in. But I talked to a reporter who said that the family wasn't going to witness. They're here in Huntsville, and I imagine they'll be at the funeral home in a few minutes. And Ron, what was your comment? Ron Carlson is here, and his sister, of course, we know was murdered by Carla Faye Tucker.
Yeah.
And he's sitting here, and he said that he was actually shocked and abhorred when he heard somebody clapping to celebrate this death. He said it made him sick to his stomach. So there was a lot of people out here, I think. I don't
70
know.
On the other corner.
70 on the other corner. Okay. And we have about 35, 36 people over here.
Well, this is very different.
Yeah, it is very different. And it's interesting that the state troopers are here. And actually, your friend Walter Boyd is here.
Which side is he on?
Both.
Well, he's on our side, but not for our reason.
He may be on the other side.
So he's just running his...
He admires us. I really do.
And he admires us. Okay,
right.
Thank you, Walter. The state troopers are here. They're not usually here. They have three cars parked right at the intersection here. And then the interesting thing that they did today, they always have the crime scene tape up, but they somehow positioned it, or they tied it to different signposts that kept us...
To divide the crowds.
5 feet farther from the death house.
Okay.
So, there's a lot more police presence, not only the state troopers, but the Huntsville police, the prison police, and I don't even know who some of these yahoos are. But the interesting thing is that there's a lot of people here from Huntsville who knew it was happening, and I went and talked to them, and they said that they were opposed to the execution. Thank you. How did you feel holding a sign for the first time? You felt good. Well, thank you for joining us. This sister lives here in Huntsville. Have you've been out here? You were here for Gary Graham? Yeah. And so she and about four or five friends, six friends are out here. You really? Okay. So they decided today they were going to hold some signs. They wanted to know if they were going to get arrested. And I said, no. And if anything happens, we got your back. So they stood and held signs for the first time. Interesting. Attitudes are changing even in Huntsville.
Gloria, give us some organizational identity.
Okay. The Texas Coalition Abolish the Death Penalty is here. The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. I guess Walter's got his own organization. Death Penalty Free Austin Movement is here, or campaign is here. and the Texas Moratorium Network from Austin is here. And then Ron Carlson is with Murder Victims Families, either for Reconciliation or for Human Rights. Oh, thank you.
Take care.
All right. Thank you all for holding the sign. Yeah, y'all be careful, too. And then one of our members is here. She visited. She knew Peter Cantu. She was a teenager when the murder happened. It just so happened that her parents and the parents of one of the gang members were friends. So as a 12-year-old, she was drugged to the trial with her parents. And then as she got a little bit older, she decided she was going to write Peter Cantu. So she's been friends with him for years and has visited him off and on, taking his family. And she's out here.
How do people get in touch with the organization, and when is the next meeting?
Next meeting is September 6th or 7th, the first Tuesday of September, and
713-503-2633.
713-503-2633? Correct. And the email is abolition.movement@hotmail.com.
And you meet at Shape Community Center?
Uh-huh, 3815 Live Oak.
And
first Tuesday of every single month.
First Tuesday of every single month at what time?
7 o'clock.
Thank you, ma'am.
And, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
And all right,
so, bye-bye. And that was Gloria Ruback, who is in Huntsville with Dennis Longmar. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, we have David Oshinsky. Oshinsky, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you're a historian, and you hold the Jack S. Blanton Chair of History at the University of Texas in Austin, and you're a visiting professor at New York University now.
That's right.
And your book on capital punishment, or the title of the book is Capital Punishment on Trial, : Furman v. Georgia and the Death Penalty in Modern America. Professor Oshinsky, when did you get interested in the issue?
I've been interested in it for a long time. I had written a book about 15 years ago about crime and punishment and violence in the American South. It was centered in Mississippi, and I became very interested in the death penalty as a form of punishment.
Now, you won a Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for this book, and it is kind of an addition to your ordeal of Jim Crow justice.
It is, although the Pulitzer Prize was actually for a book on polio.
Okay.
It wasn't for the capital punishment book.
Okay. But you relate in this book a connection between slavery and justice. Is that true?
I'm sorry. You relate
in a capital punishment on trial.
Yes.
Your interest in that grew out of an interest in slavery and.
Yes, that is correct. Obviously, African Americans are disproportionately punished when it comes to the death penalty. So that clearly was an issue I was interested in.
Well, I'm going to let you draw that parallel.
Well, what has really happened over the years is, you know, as a form of Jim Crow justice, you've kind of gone from vigilante justice to the death penalty. Throughout the South, the death penalty was used as a way of kind of enforcing white supremacy, and it really wasn't until the 1970s that the Supreme Court did away with rape as a capital offense, and it was clearly being used against African Americans throughout the South, usually very, very unjustly. What has happened over time, however, is that the numbers really have begun to become more equal in terms of race, but what still is a problem is not so much the race of the perpetrator, but the race of the victim. What clearly is now a more important issue, certainly when you're on trial, is generally what the race of the victim is. If the victim is white, you are much more likely to receive the death penalty than if the victim is non-white.
Well, of course, from my perspective in Texas, where we, you know, criminal justice is a big business down here. It's booming. It's a growth industry. And we put different values on the lives of people of different races.
Well, I think you could argue that in some ways the situation is getting better. In other words, you would be very hard pressed today, I think, to look at a white defendant and a black defendant and to single out the black defendant as the person who's going to receive the death penalty simply on the basis of race. But if you also factor in the race of the person who was killed, then you do have a problem. And that has shown up again and again in various cases. And there have been all kinds of statistical analyses that show if you kill a white person, regardless of your race, if you kill a white person, you are more likely to receive the death penalty from a jury than if you do not.
Do you suspect that there is same disparity based on gender?
Well, I think there probably is. Certainly there's gender in the case of the very, very few women receive the death penalty in that respect. I don't know in terms of the victim, but I think I would be likely to believe that if you were on trial, white or African American or of another race, and you kill a female, the jury would probably be more likely to go for the death penalty.
What side of history is this business of executing people on? Are we going to have to put up with this for the rest of time?
If you want my personal opinion,
yes.
I think this is not going to go away. I think the death penalty will be here as long as I am alive and you are alive, and I think it will continue. I think what the Supreme Court has done over the years is to clearly narrow the scope of the death penalty in terms of, you know, you can't execute juveniles, you can't execute the mentally retarded, you can basically only execute for when the capital offense is murder and the like. So I think that the parameters have been narrowed. I think that even though Americans understand that the death penalty is not a deterrent, the majority of Americans still believe that there are some crimes that are so hideous that basically the only form of just punishment is death. And I do not see that going away. I mean, there has not been a presidential candidate in my lifetime, with the exception of Michael Dukakis, who opposed the death penalty publicly, and he was thrashed for it. And President Obama supports the death penalty. So Do you
think it's part of our culture in the United States?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I think to some degree it is. I think there are all kinds of reasons. I think we see ourselves as a more religious country. We have sort of a more biblical belief of right and wrong and the form of punishment that we should mete out. So I think there is some of that there. We are still, you know, now one of the very few Western nations that still has capital punishment on the books. And I think it will remain on the books. And I think that for most Americans, I think that the issue of they do understand that there are issues of innocence involved, where, you know, in other words, you might execute an innocent person, and there is revulsion against that. I think the average jury, if it gets the chance to have life without the possibility of parole, I think the average jury largely will go for that in America today. But I think there are certain crimes. For example, the two guys who just broke out of prison in Arizona recently, and I think are still on the run. And, you know, I think at least one of them, maybe both of them, were in there for murder, and they've allegedly committed another murder while they've been on the run. So if you capture them and they are not executed, there are many people who would just see this as essentially they got away with murder. It was a freebie. It's a very difficult issue.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't know if you historians see it, but from my qualified lay position, it seems such an anachronism.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. We have always been a country that, you know, basically have very strong constitutional beliefs, more liberty than virtually in any other country in the world. Yet we've always been a country, I think, where there has been a high level of punishment for individual crimes. There are all kinds of reasons for that, going back to the Puritans. It may be an anachronism in the sense that in the 1960s, capital punishment basically was on the run. We almost stopped executing people in the 1960s. And by the time Furman v. Georgia comes along in the early 1970s, mm-hmm. and the Supreme Court temporarily stops executions, we really weren't executing anybody. It was, most people thought in the 1960s, you call it an anachronism, that capital punishment would be gone. It would be over. But what happens is, as crime starts to rise, as people get fearful of various things, then basically the death penalty as a political issue and to a lesser degree as a moral issue comes back on the table. And that is, I think, what has happened. And what I think is particularly interesting is that the vast majority of executions now are in a handful of states.
Right, and they seem to fit in a neat box south of the Mason-Dixon line and east of the Continental Divide.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there are still, you know, California still executes occasionally, Ohio and Missouri and other states. There may well be an execution in Connecticut after that atrocious, despicable home invasion you may know about. But you're quite right that Texas, Florida, and Virginia, and Georgia account for probably 90%
yeah.
of executions. And indeed, you know, there's always traditionally been one county in Texas, Harris County.
Yeah, right here. Right here where we are.
Yes, for a very, very large number of executions. Yeah,
yeah, well, of course, if you're locally, you can see that in the personalities of the prosecutorial politicians and the fact that basically what they're doing is laying their political claim. You know, I am more macho than you are because I can send more people to execution. And to get the governor of Texas to admit that an innocent person has been convicted on junk science is just an impossibility. So we have a political atmosphere down here that feeds into this. And you're giving me the very sad news that I'm going to have to put up with this the remainder of my...
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm to be perfectly frank with you, I think where you and I disagree, I am not morally opposed to capital punishment. I think in certain instances...
Well, I don't know if I'm moral enough to have an immoral opinion.
In most cases, it works.
Yeah, well, does it really deter?
Too arbitrary and capricious in the average case. I think you have a very hard time determining why one person is being executed and 40 people have committed a similar crime around the country or not. And that, I think, is a major moral issue and an issue of equity that we really do have to deal with. And I think it remains arbitrary and capricious. And I worry about, you know, things like the Innocence Project, where DNA material shows that a number of people who've been in jail and even been on death row,
sure.
indeed, were
innocent. I'm doing a radio show in New Orleans in the morning about a man from here that has spent 27 years in prison for a crime that DNA established rather conclusively that he did not commit. So that issue boils over from time to time. And you know, I'm still wrestling with my moral objection suggestion. I don't know that if my objection is moral, but I am really horrified by the fact that very similar cases have very dissimilar results
yes.
in trial and punishment.
Yes, that is I think what concerns most Americans, and that is I think why juries like to go, if they can, for life in prison without the possibility of parole, there's a sense that there is something arbitrary enough about the system that you really, to mete out the ultimate punishment, you have to have a crime that is of horrendous proportions, and anything less than that, I think, makes juries very, very wary, and rightly so. They simply know that there are similar cases elsewhere in the country, and indeed in the state, where the death penalty is not being applied. And I think they also understand that there is a power imbalance. You're in Houston, Texas. You have a prosecutor's office with so much more money and so many more resources than the people who are defending those accused of capital murder, that in many ways it's an unfair fight.
And the whole economics thing I find bewildering. It's certainly not worth your money to execute, because those are extremely burdensome things on budgets.
Yes, they are. I mean, it's obviously, you know, a capital case is obviously far more expensive for the state. But you also have studies that have shown that if you are being tried for capital murder and you have the money to hire your own defense attorney,
sure,
even for part of the defense, your chances of not getting the death penalty go up geometrically. In other words, it's...
And the cost to the state go up geometrically.
Exactly. It's really those who have no other alternative but to be given a defense attorney, you know, basically by the judge or by the court, who are going to run into the biggest problem.
No, we have whole jurisdictions in Texas who, without state subsidies, simply could not afford capital cases.
That is correct. And Texas is not the only state. That is absolutely correct.
Speaking of Texans, do they show ample respect for a Texan at New York University?
In fact, they do. And I'm very, very loyal to the state of Texas. And when I'm up in New York City in the fall, I actually go to this Longhorn bar.
Oh, okay. They've got islands of Texana in New York City.
And one of the things that is amazing is when you wear a Texas T-shirt when you're walking or jogging in Manhattan, how many Hook'em Horn signs.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's really... I love
that. There are not that many Aggies there, my co-host suggested.
There are plenty of Aggies there, actually. Not quite as many as Longhorns, however. But I really miss Texas.
Well, where are you going with this? Have you got something else going on? Are you going to analyze this issue further?
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, my newest book, and one of the reasons I'm in New York City, is I'm writing History of Bellevue Hospital, which is one of the great municipal hospitals in the United States, and the hospital that turned no one away. You know, it really is. If you were poor and you had nowhere else to go, and New York City, as you know, is a city of poor and a city of immigrants,
sure,
that was the place. So I will be writing about that, but I'm sure I will at some point be getting back to issues of criminal justice, which are always have been of great interest to me.
Well, we've been doing the prison show here on radio station KPFT in Houston for some 30 years. And so we become kind of an institution. And watching the ebb and flow of criminal justice in Texas has certainly been a fascinating endeavor for me.
I mean, boy, you are in the epicenter of the criminal justice system. Have you had on Robert Perkinson, who did?
I have. As a matter of fact, recently. We're
wonderful book.
Check the index. We'll pop up every once in a while
in
Robert Perkinson.
I just thought that was just a terrific piece.
And so whenever Texas, we finally at one point decided that in order to do justice to the seriousness of execution, that during each execution we do an execution watch show and using the HD2 channel and the World Wide Web. So all of the people that are listening to you and I right now are listening at kpft.org, theprisonshow.org, or executionwatch.org. And thank you very much, Professor. How do people get in touch with you? Is your book still in print?
Just go to the University of Texas website, you know, in my name, David Oshensky, and I'll be glad to correspond and email with any of your listeners.
Well, we have listeners all over the world for this show because Texas executions attracts an interest in Europe and Asia.
Gerard, I know that.
Japan and China.
For my travels. I know that from my travels.
So thank you very much for joining us this evening, and good luck with your new writing.
Bless, and I hope you're well.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Professor Oshinsky, David M. Oshinsky, and he says you can get in touch with him through the University of Texas website, which I expect is extensive. So, but Oshinsky is easy to identify, and it is phonetically spelled like I probably mispronounced it. And we're back, Jim. Our listeners are not on the HD2 channel. They're on executionwatch.org, kpft.org, and, of course, theprisonshow.org. Mr. Cantu's dead. That's done.
You know, one thing I was thinking about, man, we were talking about this. I thought it was interesting. We were talking about the impact of mob mentality. The day after the murders, this is a madman that's stomping body, stepping on necks, strangling people. He shows at work the next day, and they call him the Yes Sir Man because he's real polite. He works at a company. They change oil for cars. He's very courteous. In fact, the guy was shocked and realized Peter Cantu was involved in this murder because the next day, when he's away from this crowd of people, away from all the crazy stuff they'd done, he's Yes Sir and No Sir to the customers and very courteous, and everybody liked him. And it's ironical that the same person has such a different manner the day after the killings and the attitude you had the night before. And again, going back to what the impact of who you run with, what you associate, what you do, how you pump up, and how mob mentality can spill over and create horrible things like this. Because like I say, the following day, he was nothing, acted normal, very polite, very courteous, and they said he's always courteous to customers.
No, like I say, the only case similar to this that I have dealt with was the death of Paul Brassard, and the police would simply not investigate. The victim was gay, and it was the mode of the day for the police just to ignore gay homicides, and the best detectives they had said, we've got nothing to investigate. So I said, well, let me tell you how to do this. We went to the meeting, we did this. As after the trials and the conviction, everybody in that case got convicted. About half of them got probation, and about half of them got time, and then two of the probationers violated. So seven went to prison, and three have now completed their probation. Everybody's out of prison except one. And I know all of them well because I've communicated with them. And the only explanation I have for that is not the gay bashing killing that I made it to be in order to get the media's attention, because that certainly sold at the time. It was that four of them were gay.
Four of the killers?
Four of the people in the original gang were, and not closeted gay, but known by the others to be gay on the night of the killing. So that kind of takes away the gay bash, gay hate thing. But there was a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs, and an atmosphere of kind of rejection at a Houston club because some of them were just simply too drunk. And they were kids, too drunk to be allowed into the club. And they drove around looking for trouble and found it. And what started out as a fight became a homicide. And all of this can turn on a split second. And nobody is thinking clearly. Nobody. So it's kind of like hormones and instincts take over. And obviously, I've had to live with this case for the last 17 years. This case has been cooking as long as this Ehrman case. And I think it's strange that I put it at Ehrman case. But we've had basically a squad of cheerleaders in favor of this execution, working on creating an atmosphere. And Jim, I can't help but think, listening to the report from our reporter up in Huntsville, Dennis Longmire, about the anger. He seemed to be shocked about the anger that the pro-execution demonstrators had toward the anti-execution. And we're living in a very angry political era.
I'm curious about your thought about something. This was, as you know, the Cantu case was a kickoff for what they call victim impact statements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the trial's concluded, when the punishment's meted out, and the members of the family get up and say all sorts of vile things about the defendant. I wonder what that accomplishes. What's your attitude toward that? Because I've seen that done numerous times where after the conclusion of the trial, a crying mother will get up and scream and ran. In this particular case, the little girl Erdman's father got up and just almost lost control. And do you think that creates more anger, more violence, that they let the victim impact statements come into court? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think any of that contributes to the objective principle of the law. Nobody commits a crime against you and me. They commit crimes against the state, and the state standing instead of you and me then prosecute and punish that crime. And that goes back to Roman law. The whole idea of Roman law is that they were going to take the warring victim culprit out of the picture and let the state, from its more objective position, look at it more objectively. And I think that probably traces back to Hammurabi's code, is that let the state mete out the punishment so that the punishment, revenge is a terrible thing in a court.
Are you in favor of victim impact statements?
No, I think that just adds to, I think it's dramatics. I think that they've now got it timed, depends on whose court you're in. Sometimes the punishment has already been determined, but then Ted Poe was loose and fast with that, so he had listened to the impact statement and then make his decision. And that was, I thought, against the statute, but he did that in practice.
I never have understood I think it creates more harm than good to have the victim impact statements, I think. It's kind of like the tail wagging the dog, kind of like our kids are controlling us now. I know some British person came to America recently and said it's nice how well the children treat their parents. It's kind of that way now. The victims have kind of become the new standard call that they come to our courts. I don't know what the hell they've added to it other than more anger.
Yeah, I think the evolution, and that was pointed out in one news coverage that I saw, that Erdman was the first victim impact statement giver in Harris County courts. I don't know if that idea was created here or whether it was imported here from somewhere else. But I think it's counterintuitive to the idea that each case needs to be treated objectively. And I think that is a very fine principle of longstanding in the law.
And this is kind of my strange personality. What I would like, and I hate to say this, but probably, what I think would have been almost fitting in the victim impact statement, Peter Shankin, too, shot the finger at Erdman. That's a horrible thing to say, but at least it would diffuse him.
Because they
voted to kill him. What more could they do to him,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Humiliation, some people say that humiliation actually is probably a more deterrent than sending people to jail and prison.
And the truth of the matter is, it's not, to me, evidence of morality to be outraged by horrible crime. I remember once Joe Keegans was a district judge here in Houston, those of you who don't know.
Very special lady.
And she said to me one time, I just don't truck with child molesters. Well, most people don't. That's not exactly a real strong moral stance, Judge Keegan. That isn't exactly putting your life on the line, being super moral.
She and I got into that on a prison show one time. She was a guest on the prison show. And I tried to get her to be objective about it, and we almost got into it right there.
And I feel the same way too. When a lot of these judges would get on the bench, and when they do all this orating about a horrible creature this person is, that's not really a fair fight because the guy can't answer back to the judge. If they want to be brave, they'll go back in the holdover cell toe to toe and see that to each other.
Yeah, right.
Then we will see who really means what they have to say. It's pretty easy when you've got a robe and a couple of bailiffs guarding you to be real pompous and moral.
But aren't we supposed to have some principle of objectivity in these things?
I thought that's what a trial is all about.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim.
Yes.
If everything had changed, everything, in this case. And Cantu had shown up in courtroom with a really wonderful lawyer. Was there any chance?
No. He had two confessions and his family testified against him. So
so he was down the river. I don't care.
Because, see, one of
a lawyer could not have passed.
Here's one of the things that people forget. When this guy was talking earlier about having a rich lawyer being able to defend you, it isn't just the lawyer. It's what the money the lawyer can buy. I mean, what the lawyer can buy. If you've got plenty of money, you can hire all sorts of psychiatrists, all sorts of experts, all sorts of investigators that you cannot hire. It isn't the fact that the rich person can hire the best lawyer in the world, is he can get the best defense. He can pay for it by hiring psychiatrists, hiring mitigation experts. He can hire
You mean the lawyer doesn't get to keep all that money?
No. As a matter of fact, and that's why they overlook that, it's not that the high-priced lawyer does all the work, is that the person with money can afford a lot of other stuff.
Did Richard Haynes know this when he represented Cullen Davis?
If you recall the last little scrape that Richard got in to. They was involving a Vietnamese family. He charged close to $1 million to represent the guy. But about half of that, most of it went to investigative fees and hiring people to figure out what the hell these Vietnamese people were doing with money laundering. So it's not just to be able to hire a rich lawyer, it's being able to hire experts to help that lawyer. Because one of the issues in this appeal on Cantu is they wanted mitigation experts, some experts appointed to help them in their defense. Well, they have to show a special need. Well, if you're rich, you don't have to show a special need. You can just hire
just
them.
Hire it.
So it's not just the lawyer by itself. It's what the money can buy by way of help to help the lawyer.
Well, I mean, do court-appointed lawyers have the resources they need to defend them?
No.
Will a public defender's office have resources?
No.
So that's a catch-22.
Here's the ironical thing about it. There was an article in New York Times about 3 years ago, and a New York judge, and they have a very active public defender program in the federal system, he was shocked to discover that as a general rule, people who are defended by the public defender get a lot more time than people who have private lawyers.
So, Jim, thank you very much. I've just been informed by the technical wizard that we're out of here. You're
okay.
Listening to executionwatch.org, kpft.org, or theprisonshow.org. Our producer is Elizabeth Ann Stein. Our technical director is the wizard, Otis McClay. The music is Death by Texas by Victoria Panetti. I'm Ray Hill. Thanking Jim Skelton and our other guests for making this show so successful. And good night.